Hello and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong speaking to you from here in Istanbul. Thanks for tuning in. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Remember to consider joining as a member to help support Turkey Book Talk. Membership gives you various exciting extras. They include an archive of 231 book reviews written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East and Europe. The archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but now a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. Members also get transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. In addition, membership gets you transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 70 conversations and well over 200,000 words. The archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. And finally, members also get access to a very nice 30% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a terrific archive of titles and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and general interest, available at cut price exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have appeared on the podcast so far, so becoming a member is a great way to get more acquainted with their work. To become a member and help us keep going, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account, which you can find a link to at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or by doing a quick Google search. At present, we post new episodes every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. And if you're not sure about it for yourself, why not just sign up for a friend or colleague who may be interested? It's something to consider anyway. But now let's get on with our latest episode. In it, we hear from Yiğit Akın of Tulane University, the author of When the War Came Home, The Ottomans' Great War and the Devastation of an Empire, published by Stanford University Press. We've spoken in previous episodes of this podcast about the First World War and its aftermath in the wider region, but Akın's book focuses mostly on the massive effect that the war had on the Ottoman home front in Anatolia and Istanbul, examining petitions, diaries, letters, newspapers, folk songs and religious texts to paint a vivid portrait of the era. The conflict, of course, brought about the process that led to the collapse of the empire and had cataclysmic social, economic and demographic consequences, including mass conscription, widespread food shortages and ethnic cleansing. At the beginning of the war in 1914, the population of the Ottoman Empire was estimated to be around 19 million. Out of the 2.9 million civilians mobilized into the armed forces, the empire suffered 750,000 fatalities from combat and disease by the war's end. Another 750,000 soldiers were wounded, and 250,000 ended up in foreign captivity. I started by asking Yiğit Akın to reflect generally on the enormous upheaval that the Great War brought about in all areas of life in the Ottoman Empire.
Cataclysm, you used the word, it's very, very apt to describe the Ottoman experience. World War I was probably the most important cataclysm that fell upon the Ottoman Empire. James Galvin, one of the major historians of the Middle East, defined World War I as the most important political event of the modern history of the region. I wanted to expand that and also add the social to that political dimension. I think World War I is also the most important social event in the modern history of the region. It destroyed basically the social capital, especially in some regions, the social capital of the Ottoman Empire. Especially the male population between 20 and 45 was devastated. You mentioned the huge number of deaths, 750,000 people from fatalities and diseases, but also 750,000, almost equal number of people, came back with visible and probably many more with invisible scars. And this is not only true for Anatolia, but also true for the Arab provinces as well, especially Palestine, Greater Syria, especially Northern Mesopotamia, were also deeply, deeply affected regions by the war. In addition to that wartime fatalities, for example, we also have to talk about the Armenian genocide. In addition to that, a huge amount of people who were forced to or voluntarily left their homelands. One-tenth of every Ottoman during the war became either a deportee or a refugee. That also affected the lifespan of people, destroyed communities, and eventually destroyed the social fabric of the Ottoman Empire.
The book is really extensively researched, and the sources that you looked at are very diverse indeed. So what you get is this kind of almost panorama of the situation. It's very vivid, almost kind of novelistic in parts. And you obviously both looked at official sources, but also the writings, correspondence and whatnot, diaries of ordinary people across the empire. And one thing that comes through very strongly is this contrast between the official narrative propagated by the authorities of, you know, a nation of an empire united, and the reality of general reluctance, suspicion, or exhaustion on the part of the population. Just talk about this schism between the official narrative of the war and the more down-to-earth reality on the ground.
I'm glad you asked this question, because studying the late Ottoman Empire, and especially studying the war, World War I, required historians to use many, many sources. And now we are luckier than the previous decades of historians, because especially in the last 10, 15 years, so many diaries, especially in Turkish, but also in Arabic and in other languages, have been published. And these are mostly written by not exactly very ordinary Ottomans, but, you know, some, you know, lower ranking or middle ranking officers or, you know, civilians. These, of course, shed a different light, especially if they are diaries, shed a different light in our understanding of the war itself and also the process of the disintegration of the empire. But still, keep in mind, I mean, this is a society where the level of literacy is very low. According to 1927 census, only 10% of the population was literate. And if you go to the countryside, we can expect that this number is much lower. And if you look at the women in the countryside, this number is much, much lower. So we are basically talking about, if you want to study the huge mass of Ottoman people's wartime experiences, we have to find alternative ways, alternative resources. One thing that I came across is the folklore accounts, which were very enlightening and very, very surprising, because they describe a completely different picture of the war. They, first of all, they read the war, they interpreted the war through the prism of individual and the family, not through the prism of the nation or religion or, you know, broader constructions. They talk about the disaster that the war brought upon them. They talk about the untended fields. They talk about the conscripted young boys. They talk about widows. They talk about orphans. They talk about the war as a disaster. But they don't talk about heroism. They don't talk about pride. They don't talk about fighting for the glorious empire, for the glory of the empire. They don't talk about fighting for the Sultan or to save the caliphate. The discrepancy between the propaganda, and this is, remember, this is the war when the Ottomans used modern propaganda to an unprecedented extent. So we see a genuinely well-developed, not very extensive, but kind of developed propaganda attempt. But the discrepancy between the propaganda, official narrative of the war, and the people's understanding of the very same experience is shocking for the historians. And of course, it's a pleasure to write about that. People, especially in the countryside, especially in the lower classes, understood the war in a completely different way than the propaganda described. I mostly used Turkish sources to look at that, but I'm sure sources in other languages would reveal the same fact. And the Europeans who experienced the war expressed their feelings in countless diaries, in tens of thousands of letter books, in countless memoirs. Although we have some of this now at hand, we are not that lucky. But those alternative sources reveal how Ottomans feel about the war. These people, even though they are illiterate, even though they were probably disconnected from the grand narratives of the empire or imperial war, still express their discontent with losing a loved one, for example, or the conscription of their young boys, or the impressment of their farm animals. All of these, the folklore accounts, I use them extensively in this book, are fascinating sources.
And one of the results of public wariness as the war went on was desertion from the army. Obviously, conscription was steadily kind of expanded throughout the war. But as you describe it, there was a large number of people who just refused to fight or deserted after getting conscripted in. Especially in the last 2 years of the war, desertion rates soared. And basically, the army just sort of melted away gradually. Just talk about this constant problem of desertion, and what kind of numbers are we actually talking about here?
Actually, we are talking about huge numbers. My dear friend and colleague Mehmet Beşikçi published a very important study in 2012 about this, about the mobilization and the desertion during World War I. And the numbers we are talking about are huge. By the end of the war, even the official sources are talking about 500,000 deserters. So this is an enormous number. And basically, as you said, by the end of the war and in the last 2 years of the war, the Ottoman army basically melted away. And the Ottoman state and the government lost its ability to keep the army intact. There were many reasons of desertion, and depending on where these soldiers are conscripted and sent, they, for example, deserted their ranks because of the difficulty of the conditions, because of lack of food, lack of weapons, lack of ammunition. In my book, I highlighted the connection between desertion and the soldiers' concern about their families. So one of the main arguments of this book is that that connection between the soldier, even though the soldier himself and the family members themselves are illiterate, the connection between the soldier and the family members continued. Soldiers did everything to keep their families informed about their fate and wanted to get informed about their families' fate and experiences during the war. And their concern, they're very concerned about the families and their safety, is one of the major reasons, if not the most important reason, of desertion. The hundreds of thousands of soldiers basically deserted their ranks. It's difficult to count, of course, how many soldiers deserted because of that very reason, but we can easily say, you know, hundreds of thousands of deserted their ranks because of the concern they felt about their family members. Families, by the way, soldiers' families, were constantly encroached upon, attacked, assaulted on the home front. The state could not provide the physical security for these families, could not maintain their well-being. And the soldiers get immediately informed about these experiences. World War I is a very important, unprecedented experience for the Ottoman soldier, because for many of them, for the vast majority of Ottoman young men, this is the very first time that they were out of their villages, out of their small hometowns. The war took them to different corners of the empire, be it Mesopotamia, be it Palestine, be it the Balkans, be it in Europe. They came across different soldiers. They came across, they met different people from different regions of the empire. But still, at the end of the day, their very communities, their very families, their very neighborhoods defined who they were. So the soldiers did everything to keep contact with their families. And in the last two, especially in the last 2 years of the war, most of the families suffered a lot from lack of provisions, loss of their farm animals, loss of their working hands, or simply the lack of security in the countryside. Soldiers either to provide that security to their families or help with the farm work basically deserted their ranks. And the number, as I tried to show in this book, was huge. And by the end of the war, there were only a fraction of those numbers who were still fighting in the ranks of the Ottoman army.
So we're talking about the contrast between the abstract concepts of protecting the empire and sacrificing your life for religion and the reality for many soldiers of their role as the head of their family and the duties they had to their home and their village. But obviously the imperial authorities used various methods to try and promote the war and inspire loyalty. One of those was the declaration of jihad at the start of the war. It was kind of inspired by Germany, the wartime ally. And also I didn't realize that this was actually when the idea of Mehmetçik, the idea of, you know, the every man soldier fighting for the state first emerged. It was quite surprising to read that.
Yeah, jihad is, of course, an attractive subject, especially nowadays. And, you know, there are new studies about the Ottoman jihad during World War I. One of the main, of course, jihad aimed to reach the Muslims of the empire, to call them to fight for the caliphate, to fight for the caliph, to fight the last stronghold of Islam, and especially to provoke the Muslims living in the British and the French colonies to fight against their colonial masters. But the recent literature and my work as well argue that probably the more important function of jihad is to encourage the very Ottoman soldier to fight. In that sense, the religion was used extensively to encourage Ottoman soldiers first to enlist, then to fight in the ranks, not to desert, and also die a hero's death in those ranks. This extensive use of religious discourse, it shows us that the Unionists, these are the members of the Committee of Union and Progress, which was in power since 1913, realized that keeping a huge army intact is a very complex thing, and it cannot be achieved by compulsion alone. So keeping such a huge army, mobilizing, first of all, such a huge army, and keeping it in the battlefields for 4 long years required much more than compulsion. Compulsion was, of course, a huge part of that equation, and the Ottoman state and the army used compulsion a lot. But also they supplemented this with ideology, with patriotism. Religion was an important dimension of that. But I also realized the unprecedented use of a figure, a distinct figure, Mehmetçik, the ordinary soldier. It actually started in the Balkan Wars. The term Mehmetçik existed, but it wasn't used that extensively. It started in the Balkan Wars, but became such a huge figure during World War I. Not the commanders, not the upper-ranking military officers, but the very ordinary Ottoman soldier showing signs of heroism, fighting a hero's death. That figure was developed in literature, in propaganda, and was, you know, distributed pretty widely. And that same process continued during the War of Independence, the Turkish War of Independence. And the ordinary soldier remained a central figure that would keep, metaphorically, of course, that would keep the Ottoman battlefront and the home front together. But of course, under the pressure of the huge number of casualties and the home front privations, we see the collapse of that discourse as well. So it became kind of ineffective. And all these folklore accounts show us that people do not see these as unnamed ordinary heroes, but they saw them as their beloved sons or fiancés or, you know, sweethearts or husbands or fathers. So again, we see that this huge discrepancy between the understanding of the ordinary Ottoman soldier here.
Now, we mentioned the Balkan Wars there. The First World War in the Ottoman Empire really can't be understood without the narrative being taken back to the Balkan Wars, at least. And these wars that started in 1912, it basically involved the empire confronting a Balkan alliance of states, Montenegro, Greece, Bulgaria, and it resulted in the Ottoman Empire being driven out of much of Eastern Europe, and it led to the expulsion of hundreds of thousands of Muslims from their ancestral homelands, and they were driven into Anatolia. And the Ottoman defeat in the Balkan Wars had a huge negative psychological effect on the empire and its administrators. It plunged them into shock and kind of evoked a dramatically heightened sense of vulnerability among the authorities. And, you know, many drew the conclusion that extreme or sweeping measures were now the only way to prevent complete destruction of the empire. So there was this kind of sense of existential crisis that was floating around in the years before the First World War. And then obviously that was stepped up during the First World War. Just talk about how the Balkan War affected ordinary life for citizens of the Ottoman Empire.
Balkan Wars had an enormous impact on how the Ottomans fought the First World War. And this is one of the main distinguishing characteristics of the Ottomans' war or wartime experience from other belligerents' wartime experiences. Because I believe the Balkan Wars has the most important, most formative impact on the Ottomans. None of the major belligerents of the war, for example, had such a wartime experience just a couple of years before the war. Balkan Wars actually had two major impacts on the Unionists, on the Ottomans in general, but especially on the members of the Committee of Union and Progress. First of all, it revealed to them the changing nature of warfare. And this is a very important revelation. This is a very important realization on their part. And after that, we see a number of policies together with revealing the weaknesses of the empire, military and political weaknesses of the empire. It showed them that the modern warfare requires a complete integration between front and the home front, between military and the civilians. And second, it also raised the specter of the collapse of the empire. The Ottoman army fought, especially the First Balkan War, disastrously. And it showed the Unionists and others as well, the army lacks the very capability of fighting effectively, including the ordinary soldier. So that's also an important revelation. And all in all, this raised the specter of the collapse of the empire, leading the Unionists to see the future in apocalyptic terms. Existential crisis, the term that I use in the book, is very true. If you read what they write, what they wrote in their diaries, in their memoirs, you clearly see that they understood the future in those terms. If you lose one more war, similar to the Balkan Wars, we are done. The empire is gone. So that's a very, very hot issue. That's a very burning issue that they discuss among themselves and with others. They also realized that the empire had been pushed into diplomatic isolation. So that's also one of the most important formative impacts of the Balkan Wars. During the war, the great powers, especially the great powers of Europe, always supported the enemies of the Ottomans. And the Unionists believed that there is no reason that this would change in a future conflict. And in a future possible conflict, they realized they had to rely on their own power. And as a result of this, they undertook a number of steps, like military reforms, very important one, the military reform of 1914, a new law of conscription, which I discuss in this book, had a huge totalizing impact on the Ottoman society because it increased the number of potential conscripts unprecedentedly. It increased the numbers, it increased the age of those conscripts, etc. And thirdly, and probably most importantly, the Balkan Wars also led the Unionists to realize that diplomatic isolation and the weaknesses of the empire, these two conditions, led to a distinctively heightened political energy among the Muslim and non-Muslim minorities of the empire. So they were concerned about that. And especially in the case of non-Muslims, they came to believe that they were pretty unreliable. So it's pretty attractive to establish a direct connection here between that realization of unreliability of the non-Muslims and the later calamities. I wouldn't go that far, but certainly this is an important revelation that the Unions came out of the war. And as a result, as I said, they undertook a number of steps, number of reforms, which dramatically increased the totalizing impact of the next conflict, the First World War, on the Ottoman society. Unlike many other belligerents, the Ottomans entered the war with a new conscription law and with a leadership determined that the next defeat of the empire would be its last defeat.
So going on at this time, there was also a rhetorical or ideological shift in the regime. Previously, there'd been an emphasis on brotherhood and the unity of various religious groups in the empire, and this kind of vague notion of Ottomanism trying to create this sense of unity in previous years. But really, starting with the Balkan Wars and into the First World War, there was this sharp shift towards a more Islamically infused rhetoric and religious propaganda to rouse the feelings of soldiers and the general public. Just talk about this shift and why it occurred, you know, within this broader picture of the Balkan Wars and the First World War.
That's a very important shift. They pretty quickly realized that on the battlefield, the Ottoman non-Muslims, also non-Turkish Muslim minorities, were not entirely reliable. They are not as willing to fight. You know, they are not dedicating themselves. You know, at least this is their perception. I mean, the very ordinary Turkish soldier during the Balkan War did the same thing. They were not really willing to sacrifice their lives. This is why that was a big disaster. But the ideological shift as a result of the Balkan War disaster came in a couple forms. It's not a clear-cut change of policies or change of ideological orientation from Ottomanism to Turkism, as it was sometimes argued in the literature. That's too simple. Actually, the Unionists wanted to reconstruct Ottomanism on new terms. And in that new construction of Ottomanism, non-Muslims were clearly excluded from that new construct, new understanding, new imperial configuration. Non-Muslims were clearly excluded from that new configuration. But the Muslims were not. So the Unionists in those important years of 1913-1914 spent pretty good intellectual and political energy to argue for a new type of imperial configuration based on the brotherhood of the Muslims of the empire, and most importantly, the brotherhood between Turks and Arabs. In this way, they eliminated the political energy which they realized as existed among the Arabs as well towards autonomy, if not independence. They eliminated, they pacified that energy. They couldn't do the same thing and probably did not want to do the same thing for Armenians, for example. Greeks, the huge Greek minority of the Ottoman Empire, had already been lost in the eyes of the Unionists. Armenians were not yet. After the Balkan Wars, even though they saw them unreliable, they were still in conviction that some sort of compromise could be achieved between the Unionists and the leadership of the Armenian political parties, especially the Dashnaks. But it wasn't possible. And as a result, the Unionists entered the war based on that new imperial configuration, based on the brotherhood between the Turks and the Arabs. It's easy or it's attractive to establish a direct connection between that ideological shift and the later Armenian genocide. I'm not that convinced that this was the reason, because the mobilization on the ground and the devastating impact of the wartime experiences played probably more important role than this, especially in 1915.
So conscription in the army became stricter and more comprehensive throughout this process. There was this patriotic fervor and rhetoric around this that the authorities tried to cultivate. But obviously many people continued to see military services as an intrusion, and as we mentioned, desertion rates were very high. Could you just talk a bit about how military service in the First World War differed between different religious groups, specifically Muslims and Christians, because there was a differentiation there? How did that develop over the course of the war?
That's an important question, and we need more studies to understand all various dimensions of this experience. Now there are some recent written dissertations and studies about the Ottoman non-Muslims' experiences of their military service. But mostly as a result of the Balkan Wars, the Ottoman army, the headquarters entered the war basically in their formulation, this should be a Muslim army. Because they realized one of the important realizations of the Balkan Wars was the most important motivating factor or the motivating discourse for the soldiers, for the ordinary soldier, was religion. Not patriotism, not secular understanding of the Ottoman nation, but religion played the most important encouraging role for the soldiers, and they wanted to use this, hence the jihad and other types of religious propaganda. But this didn't let them exclude non-Muslims from the military service. As I said, in 1914, the new law of conscription required all Ottoman males, except for the Ottoman royal family, to do their military service, and it actually limited the exemption fee, the bedel, the infamous bedel, to peacetime. But the Ottomans entered the war and declared the mobilization under very difficult financial circumstances. They really couldn't do this, so extended the acceptance of exemption fee to wartime as well. So one reason that they didn't exclude non-Muslims from this process, from the conscription, is to collect exemption fee, which was, by the way, a serious money, to extract that money from the non-Muslims. In some provinces, the mayors or other administrators openly told the non-Muslims to pay that fee, told them that, you know, the only reason that they were called into the colors is pay the fee and do not serve. But of course, many could not pay that huge amount of money. That's a significant money for many Ottomans. And many non-Muslims could not actually pay that fee. They decided to serve by themselves. From early 1915 on, this was the time, of course, remember, this was the time when the Ottomans suffered from a huge defeat before the Russian army in eastern Anatolia, the infamous Sirkomish defeat. From early 1915 on, we see the first signs that non-Muslim, especially Armenian non-Muslims, were separated into different ranks. Their weapons were taken away. Their uniforms were taken away, and they were separated into labor battalions. And tens of thousands of them served physically under terrible circumstances in these labor battalions. Labor battalions were not designed to kill them, but actually the empire needed these labor battalions because, you know, they were used for many purposes, you know, to construct roads, to clear the fields, to cut the trees, to do the transportation job, etc. But in the second half of 1915, when the deportation of Armenians started, many Armenians who served in these labor battalions were basically killed by the armed gangs. And Erik Yang Zürher, important historian of the late Ottoman Empire, used the term sitting ducks for these Armenians, because they didn't have the weapons and they were, you know, under the guard of the Ottoman soldiers. And these were the ones, probably the first groups who were killed during the genocidal process.
Now, obviously, the book examines the home front in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War, and one of the chapters focuses on women left behind. As in other belligerent countries, World War I really changed women's role and public presence in the Ottoman Empire. It's quite interesting. I'd never really thought about it before, but this really was something that is kind of mirrored in the example of Britain, you know, during the Second World War, famously. You know, this was when women started to work in factories and they really began to assert themselves in public, and something very similar happened in the Ottoman Empire on a kind of smaller scale during the First World War. With so many men conscripted, the women left behind often had to work as part of the war effort, and they increasingly came into contact with the authorities, and basically they entered the arena, the public arena, as never before. Just talk a bit about how the war affected women across the Ottoman Empire, and what kind of more lasting changes did this help to bring about?
The war had an enormous impact, as we discussed so far. The war had an enormous impact on almost every atom. There is probably no aspect of life, especially everyday life, which was left untouched by the war. The war affected the education system. The war affected the political configurations. The war affected how the society functions, basically. But still, I argue in this book that it was women who bore the brunt of the war. They were left behind by the soldiers who were conscripted. And remember one more thing, the comparison between other belligerents and the Ottoman Empire is, of course, appealing and attractive. But still, we are talking about, in the case of the Ottoman Empire, a truly agricultural society, an agricultural economy. At one point in this book, I have an argument that the Ottomans fought this first truly industrial war of history, of modern history, without a significant industry. The Ottoman economy was based on agriculture, and women on the home front found themselves with the conscription of a huge number of men, and especially young men. These were the people who actually did the agricultural work during the peacetime. In the absence of them, women felt obliged or found themselves in a position to continue the life, especially in the countryside. They were also deeply affected in the cities as well. Many middle-class families, for example, after the conscription of their breadwinner, many middle-class women found themselves working in military workshops, stitching the uniforms for the army factories, for the army units. İrfan Orga, for example, wrote a great memoir of his mother and his family's experiences showing that. And the new book published by my colleague Elif Mahir Metinsoy about the Ottoman women's experiences during war showed this very aptly. In that chapter, I argue that in addition to the house chores, the work they already did before the conscription mobilization, women found themselves in a very difficult situation of doing that agricultural work and many additional things on top of their original duties. This, of course, devastated many of them. This was a very, very hard life, and many, many women suffered actually dramatically in this process. In addition to that enormous extra workload, women also interacted with the state officials unprecedentedly. They wrote many petitions. The Ottoman archives has many of these petitions. They wrote petitions. They basically ran into the administrative offices, protested military and civilian, high-ranking officers and civilian politicians, basically to ask that the state keep its promise to soldiers' families. They imply a contract. They imply a contract between the state and a soldier's family. In the absence of the soldier, the state basically promised to protect these families and provide for their well-being. But especially in the second half of the war, this wasn't the case, as we discussed previously. These families, especially soldiers' families, but almost all women, especially in the countryside, found themselves under very, very difficult circumstances. And they realized that the state is actually not helping them. The government is unable and, worse, unwilling to keep its promise. So all their petitions, all the letters they wrote to Talat Pasha, to other important political figures, imply either explicitly and many times implicitly that the state is not keeping its promise towards these soldiers' families. And they sometimes forcefully argue that, we sent that number of sons to the army, now it's your turn to keep its promise. Pay the pensions, for example, or, send someone to keep security in our village, or, do not confiscate our, grain, last piece of grain, for example. Interestingly, or maybe not interestingly, we see a truly collective effort in this process. Women in many of these petitions, almost none of them, were written by an individual woman. Almost all of them, they were written collectively, sometimes signed and sealed by, 30 women, 50 women. And in couple documents, I even found the collaboration between Muslim and non-Muslim soldiers' families. So local Greek soldiers' families, these were Greek Orthodox, and the Muslims cooperated and write the same thing because they were suffering from the same conditions. So in that sense, women worked a lot, suffered a lot during the war, longed for their loved ones, lost their loved ones. And at the beginning of this podcast, you give the number that even after a decade, in some provinces of the former empire, 30% of women were still widows. So this is a huge number. But at the same time, came into increasing contact with the state authorities, with state discourses, with state policies. And eventually, in the later years, we see, for example, during the War of Independence, a much more intensified activity of women. They, this time, not only wrote these petitions and appealed to state, but also, for example, organized meetings to protest either foreign governments or the local policies. they did not get the voting rights as a result of this activism, but certainly they managed to act collectively under very, very difficult circumstances.
That was Yiğit Akın. Many thanks to him. Remember to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member if you enjoy the podcast and want to help support it. Membership gets you access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 70 conversations so far. Members also get a hefty 30% discount on a catalogue of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history published by IB Taurus. To become a member, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's Patreon account, and if you're personally not sure, then why not consider signing up as a gift for a friend or colleague who may be interested. Should make for a very exciting Christmas gift. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.